Did you know of the Requiem Mass which my father held for you on a day of the funeral?
H.J.L.
Yes, but I did not know that it was on the same day. I knew of it what appeared to be some time before. That service was of far more use to me than a funeral service. It is strange that so many Christians devote all their attention to the body, which knows and cares nothing about what is going on, and entirely neglect the spirit, which is often in great need of help. I was going through one of those terrible days, of course they are not days, but I know no other name to give them for you, when my former deeds crowded upon me on every side. These days come on me even still, they are part of my punishment, and are sent to enable me to repent. I, of course, could not go to school, and was there overwhelmed with misery, when, lo, a bright flame seemed to force its way through my nightmare visions and dissolve them. Slowly in their place there came a vision of a church with an altar on which were candles and a cross, and before it was a priest. I recognized him as your father and, further, saw you kneeling there. But though you two were the only mortals, you were not alone. Who they were who knelt beside you I cannot say, but certainly the whole church, not merely the side chapel, was full of worshippers who had come from our side. No words of mine can express the joy that this sight filled me with. Firstly, I rejoiced that there were at least some on earth who really cared and believed enough to pray for me, and the thought and the words of the service filled me with a wonderful peace. But even beyond this came the inspiring thought that hundreds of others who had come here before, had possibly trodden the same hard road as I was treading, were interested in my progress and prayed for me. Oh Jack, I never knew how much good might be hidden in that wonderful contradictory old national church of ours. Tennyson must have received some inspiration from this side when he retained in his Morte d'Arthur those closing lines of Murray, clean contradictory as they must have been to the ideas of the mid-Victorians, pray for my soul. You know the rest, don't you? J. W.
Yes, well. By the by, as animals come here, have you seen anything of old Molly?
Carrie's dog.
H. J. L.
Oh yes. She often comes to me. As there is no one else here she knows, I think. There she is.
J.
W.
Where?
I can't see her.
H. J. L.
Here she comes.
As he spoke,
Molly came rushing out of a small wood close by. She looked somewhat younger than when she died and had quite lost her hump, but otherwise there seemed no, gone west, change. She jumped and capered about, first round H.
J.
L. and then round me, wagging her tail and barking with excitement. I made her walk on her hind legs, as she used to do. Presently she curled up beside H.
J.
L. If animals survive in this state, I asked, what becomes of them when the frontier of this plane is reached? Do they, too, go on to the fifth plane?
H. J. L.
That is one of the points we are investigating. I have particularly asked P. to inquire in his division. This leads me to try and fix the terms I use for our divisions here. I am afraid they have been a little incoherent. I will therefore use henceforth, plane equals the whole of this realm of the spiritual body. Realm equals the divisions of this plane, for example the realm of half-belief. Division equals the divisions of each realm, for example the schools or the divisions of hell. Subdivisions equals the splitting up of the divisions as among the sects in the realm of belief without acts, for example the Roman Catholics or Baptists. Spheres equals the groups into which we drift during the times we are having recreation. They bring together men in different divisions of the same realm, but not those who are in different realms. Moreover, a man will sometimes be in one sphere and sometimes in another, for example the sphere of architecture or music. Now, as to next Saturday's work, P. is very anxious to start writing, so I shall let him. He will give an account of his passing on to the realm above. Strictly, I ought to write first an account of the entrance of the officer into our realm as seen by me, it occurred first, and also what I know of P.S. passing, but I will do so after he has written. I will, however, tell you how I met P. I had been inquiring about the realm below and that above, and suddenly a man came to me and said,
I have been down to hell on a little missionary work, so perhaps I can give you some information." I was delighted. He told me about the divisions of hell, and that he had been sent to teach the souls in the schools. He was not allowed to go any lower, but even that had retarded his progress. He hoped, however, soon to be allowed to pass on to the realm above us. He said, further, that the souls in hell were terribly hard to teach, far harder than the worst types of people on earth, and this in spite of the fact that none had reached the seventh division unless they desired to progress. "If you really wish to know about the depths of hell, I know the man who can tell you," P. added. "He was an army officer, and I have been teaching him for some time. He will soon be admitted into this realm, and I will introduce him to you and ask him to help you. I was privileged to help him and feel sure he will do what I wish in the matter. He is a man with a tremendous personality, and made good progress. You may still think him a fairly unregenerate blackguard, but I assure you he is enormously improved. When he first came to me, he was by far the worst in the whole school, and I often wondered why he had been admitted, but he rapidly passed all the others." "Are there schools like ours in hell?" I said. "H. J. L. They are almost impossible to compare," P. replied. "The nearest simile which occurs to me is, as a school for mentally afflicted children is to a first-class secondary school on earth. Even that does not show the full difference. The schools for the babies, which I never entered, correspond fairly closely to the kindergartens on earth, though of course different subjects are taught. Many other things P. described to me, and I have given you them from time to time. But I was not long to have the advantage of his company, for soon after the passing up to us of the officer, P.S. guide took him away for his final preparations for his own passing on. Gone west, before going, he obtained from his guide a promise that he might on occasion return to us, as he had gone down into hell, to bring us the news we desired. Now I have given you enough. Consider me at the university with other students working at this subject which I have chosen, the subject being to discover all I can about the conditions of life here in all the realms, and to transmit this knowledge to you. Consider me surrounded by many fellow students all working at the same problem, further, as having recreations and amusements approximating to those which are the highest on earth. All these mental amusements are carried on a far higher plane. There are also recreations of which you know nothing on earth. Now goodbye for the time being, Jack. Think of me and pray for help for me. See, I can fly now." He rose in the air and floated away across the lake, and I stood watching the rosy light of the oversetting sun tinging the waters of the lake. Then I knew no more. J. W. Gone West. Chapter 14. Little Blanche sees H. J. L. Blanche sees H. J. L. February 26th. C. W. and Blanche were in the drawing room at 7 p.m., and B. wandered up to the window and looked out at the sky from the darkened room. The sky was covered with stars. She exclaimed, "I see the big granddad crossing the sky. He's got a candle or torch in his hand with a star for the light. He keeps moving backwards and forwards. Now he has gone into a room and is learning something. He has a book." Immediately after she said, "I can see him coming along again. A little girl is following him, like Betty, a six-year-old cousin, only she has reddish hair. 7 She has a doll in her hand. Now he's talking to her and holding her hand. Earlier she said, he pulled me, I felt him. Sometime later, about 7:45, C.W. and she went out in the garden to see the stars. She then said, there is the big granddad, he has picked a bunch of stars. They are flowers to him, he's putting them in a vase. A correct summary. C. W. Gone West. Chapter 15. How H. J. L. met the officer, transvision and conversation, March 2, 1914. During these I seemed to be transferred to another country or plane of existence. I found myself seated by the side of the river, and beside me was H. J. L. "Carrie wants to know," I began, "whether you can take off the clothes and, laying them aside, get into others? Do you understand my meaning? Of course I perceive the idea in your mind. The clothes are made into their present form by my will. When I wish them to assume another shape, for example when I am on the earth plane and wish them to resemble my former earth clothes, they do so. I don't take them off and change them as you do on earth. Our clothes do not wear out, of course. They remain as we think them, and if we want to change them we think the change, and there are the new clothes. J. W. Blanche said she saw you picking stars, which were flowers to you. Was this so? HJL. I often pick flowers, and I suppose they looked as bright as stars to her, and she mixed them up with the stars, which she saw with her mortal sight, as distinct from her spiritual sight, with which she sees me. J.W. Do you know who the little red-beaded girl is? HJL. She has just come here, and I happened to see her looking rather lonely, and so began to interest myself in her. She's gone up to the girls' schools here. J.W. Oh, then they don't have co-education? HJL. Not exclusively, though they have it for some children. You see, here like attracts like. J.W. Have you seen many women? HJL. Not many as yet. Later we see more of them. Now I'll go on with my narrative. J.W. Before you do so, tell me, don't the flowers die when you pick them? HJL. Oh no. Why should they? They are forms, and still retain those forms even if picked. They are simply transferred from the plant to my vase. But they do not die in the vase any more than when they are on the plant. J.W. If you pulled them to pieces, would they perish? HJL. We should never do such a thing. We realize that even the flowers have their rights. Nevertheless, the separate pieces would still exist, and would reunite. Now for my narrative. A few days after I had met P, my guide took me to see the passing up to us of a soul from hell, and his guide went with me, and we found it was the officer. I find it hard to make you understand how we got there, but suddenly we were at the edge of hell. We seemed to be on a dry, barren, rocky edge. Behind us were black rocks and hard, stony ground. The ground, which sloped up towards us from behind, in front of us broke off abruptly. Now this terrible precipice was made far more awful by the fact that at its edge all light ceased. The light seemed to become tiny particles of mist, and at the very edge these seemed to pile themselves up into a great wall against the darkness. There was no intermingling of light and dark, as on earth, simply this awful darkness, which seemed as if it were a solid curtain, or even a wall against which the light piled itself up but could not penetrate. My guide spoke, "Go to the uttermost edge of that rocky cliff and stretch out your hand into the darkness." Gone west, I went to the edge, and as I did so I felt the hand of my guide resting on my shoulder from behind to steady me. My hand went into the darkness and was immediately lost to sight. I could see my arm as far as the part where it entered the darkness, but beyond I could see nothing. Nor could I feel any sensation in the hand, save only at the place where it entered the darkness. It was more than the darkness which can be felt, it was the darkness which destroys feeling. At the part where my arm entered the darkness I felt a narrow band of intense cold, numbing and yet burning. "May I withdraw my arm?" I asked my guide. "Yes." I promptly withdrew it, and was really thankful to find it was undamaged. "Why this darkness and cold?" I inquired. My guide replied, "The light of faith does not exist here, and there is also no love of God. As you are now a spirit, you need the spiritual light and warmth, just as on earth you needed physical warmth and light." Slowly the wall of darkness began to sway to and fro. As it advanced towards the light in one place it receded in another, and the light pressed in and out. There was no interpenetration, simply an undulating line instead of a straight one. As this movement grew more and more violent I sprang back from the cliff, fearing that a fold of darkness might engulf me. But my guide said, "Stand firm. That darkness cannot reach us. There is too much faith here." And so it was, for though the folds of darkness several times swept up onto the land on either side of the spot where we were standing, it never engulfed us, and we were able to realize the awful depth of the precipice, which seemed almost unscalable. But the light gave comparatively little illumination. Suddenly out of the darkness beneath us a ball of light began to emerge, and, rapidly mounting, we saw it was a glorious spirit of light. As he rose from the depths the darkness seemed to fall from off him, to use a homely simile, like water from a duck's back. Having climbed over the edge of the cliff onto its top, he lay down and stretched his arm down into the darkness. It vanished up to the shoulder, but gradually he withdrew it, and soon we saw his hand grasped that of another. The newcomer's hand was not bright and shining like his, but dark and dirty, with a pallid, unhealthy tinge. Soon there struggled up beside him, slowly and painfully, a most miserable object. His eyes were covered with a kind of bandage. He fell to the ground beside his guide, who rose to his feet and gently helped him to rise. The newcomer wore a dark grey ragged garment, which was covered with stains, and seemed to have, as it were, patches of darkness still clinging to it. His hands and face were also stained and dirty. "Oh, this terrible light," he moaned. "I can see it even through this bandage." To us it was a very murky light, most like that seen in a London fog. "How foul his clothes are," I said to P. To us, "Yes, but if he could see them they would to him appear unwontedly clean," said P. "I expect to you your clothes appear quite clean?" "Yes," I replied. "Well, I can see many stains on them, and I have no doubt to my guide mine also appear foul." I felt very humbled by this remark and remained silent. P. stepped forward and, taking the newcomer by the hand, said, "Welcome. I am happy indeed in being allowed to greet you on your entrance into this new realm." "Gone west, is that you, my master?" said the other. "It is indeed good of you to come and welcome me. But this light is terrible. I long for the darkness again." "Oh, that will soon affect you less. This is a friend of mine who has come to welcome and help you," and he signed to me. I took the other hand of the man, whom henceforth I shall call by the name of the officer, by which you already know him. We led him slowly down the slope and then seated ourselves on the ground. Here he told me who he was on earth, which I have repeated to you briefly, and something of his life in hell. The latter I shall not give you now, as he will give it himself in due course. We stayed like this for a long time, it seemed equal to several days, but at length, when he had told us much about himself, his guide spoke. "By telling your evil life and something of what you have suffered, you have made it possible for your eyes to bear the light without the bandage." He then removed it, and the officer sank to the ground and covered his eyes with his hand. My guide then spoke, "We must now return."
"What of the officer?" I inquired.
"He will follow us, but more slowly. He cannot fly yet, but will have to climb painfully up to us." We then rose in the air. P. and I, in what seemed no time, were back in these now familiar surroundings. I gather from the officer, who arrived a short time later, it seemed like a few days, that he had had to cross a kind of stony desert which mounted up to a range of hills. When he had climbed to the crest of these, he found they sloped down but slightly towards a plain, and that plain was where we dwell. While crossing this plain, he was haunted by the most awful visions of his former evil life, similar to, but far more intense and terrible than, those I saw and suffered from. His guide came to him but rarely, and though to us we seemed to have parted from him but a few days, as it were, to him it seemed years. The visions haunt him even as they do me, but far more fiercely, and as yet they are still in the nightmare state which I described as assailing me at first. They have not yet sorted themselves out, as they did for me. He has, therefore, of course not yet started going to school. In short, he is only just in our realm. This now enables you to understand the spiritual condition of the three persons who are trying to communicate with you from here. I feel that you cannot realize how intense all these experiences are. For example, the awful horror of that darkness I cannot convey to you, and even if I did, you could not convey it to others on earth. It was a horror which seemed to choke and freeze me. It was awful beyond measure.
Gone West, Chapter 16, Guardian Angels, H.J.L. Continued. Now, is there any point you wish to raise? J. W.
This is the third time I have seen this landscape, but I have never seen your guide. Is he never with you when I am here?
HJL. Not always, but he is here at times. He is now.
Oh, my guide and friend, open his eyes still wider. Then something was placed over my eyes for a moment, and I could see nothing. The something was removed, and, behold, I could see more clearly. Behind H.J.L. stood a great spirit form made of light. His robes kept changing color and seemed to run through all the colors of the rainbow. He was far taller than H.J.L., and large in proportion, being perfectly made. He was at least three times as large as H.J.L., and his face was more beautiful than any Greek sculpture, strong, noble, well-cut features. There was nothing feminine about it, yet it was a kind, as well as a strong face. It was a face that was neither old nor young. Nor did it seem to have color, for example brown hair, as we understand it, but rather to be a figure of golden light. Yet there was both hair on the head and beard, majestic and flowing. No words can describe the majesty and beauty of this being. I can quite understand whence the ancients drew their inspirations for their gods. Then I thought, this is doubtless an angel, and I looked instinctively for his wings, but he had none. Have I not a guide? I inquired. Like the tones of a great bell rang out the word behold. Then I saw that behind me was another great spirit of light. Now, though in general aspect he resembled the guardian angel of H.J.L., I perceived that I knew this spirit. His face seemed hauntingly familiar. Yet it was an extraordinarily mobile face, the same, yet ever changing, never for an instant exactly the same, and yet always retaining certain characteristics. It was different too, markedly, from the guide of H.J.L. I knew this being of light. I felt almost as if I had seen him in my dreams, but that the dreams had been forgotten. He, too, had a beard, but not so long as that of H.J.L.'s guide, and, like him, was of far more than human size. Light seemed to emanate from his whole body. He raised his hand, and that same glorious bell-like voice spoke. Enough, it is not well that you should see more. Again the hand, for so I now perceived it to be, was placed over my eyes, and when it was removed I could see only H.J.L. and the landscape. We must part now, he said. And, rising, floated away from me. I stood looking at the beautiful landscape, lost in contemplation. Gradually I became aware of a sensation of something pulling me. In spite of strong resistance on my part, I felt myself drawn backwards as if by an invisible cord. Step by step I seemed to move uphill and away from the stream, then there was darkness. When I next became conscious, I was back in my house. Gone west. Chapter 17, Blanche sees H.J.L. and Molly, clairvoyant appearance of H.J.L. to Blanche and J.W. At 6 p.m., March 3rd, while at tea Blanche suddenly said, "Why, there's Grandad." "Show him to me," I said. "I can't see him." She went to the dining room window, the one looking east, and said, "I shan't show him to you, or he'll go away." While we were talking I began to perceive something some distance away, and soon saw, H.J.L. asked Blanche what she saw, as I saw him. She said he was in a room typing, that Rosie Dawn, the little girl, was playing on the floor. Now she's going out at the door carrying her doll. "Why, there's a brown poodle with her." "Yes," I said, "it's Molly. Don't you recognize her?" "Yes, it's Molly, mother," she cried. The vision grew faint and faded away. I saw exactly the same as she did, but H.J.L. had his back towards me, and was certainly doing something with his hands, but I don't think it was typewriting. The child had seen her other grandfather typing, and not knowing what H.J.L. was doing, interpreted his action by that of my father's. This vision was different from other appearances to me of H.J.L. It was at a distance, and appeared, as she said, to be in the sky. All others have been near to me. Only on Monday I had said to C. W., I wish I could be present next time B. says she sees anything. I think this was the answer. Gone West. Chapter 18, Men Are Self-Judged, Trans Conversation with H. J. L. During night of March 9th, I found myself in a forest glade, and seated beside me was H. J. L. He said, I think it would be as well at this point to clear up once and for all the exact relationship of faith and works. Faith must be shown forth in works. If a man really believes the teaching of Christ, for example, he will strive to follow it out in his life. A man who says with his lips that he believes the teaching and then goes on day by day breaking all the moral laws that Christianity teaches is simply a humbug. I do not mean by this the man who, though he strives, often gives way to temptation. For that man there is the realm which I call the realm of belief without acts, but I do mean the hundreds of professing Christians who make no attempt to carry out Christ's teaching, the men who go to church regularly on Sunday and spend the week in cheating and lying and so forth. These go to hell. They have not believed, and their evil life proves it. J. W. Wherein, then, does this differ from being judged solely by our acts? H. J. L. Firstly, the word judged is misused. It implies that someone outside ourselves judges us. This is not so. We stand self-condemned. Our spirit cannot rise to higher realms than those for which it has fitted itself. There is no necessity to enforce any law, for the law is self-acting. I shall make this point plain if I answer your question. The difference lies in this. Suppose a complete materialist, one who neither believes in God nor in a future life, and one who does his best to dissuade others from believing in these essentials. This man may be a real philanthropist, actuated by a noble desire to promote the material well-being of his fellow men. This man dies. How can he come even to the realm of half-belief? His spiritual body has never been developed. He could not bear the light. He must develop this spiritual body and lose the materialistic ideas before he can possibly come to us. No hard judge dooms him to hell. He goes there naturally of his own accord. Like attracts like. His lack of faith bars him out from all realms in which faith is an essential element of existence. He goes therefore to Division 5 of hell. But, though there was no love of God, there was of his fellow men, and this will save him from sinking lower and help him to desire to rise. Once the desire to progress in spiritual matters disappear, that progress will probably be sure and continuous. But unfortunately the materialistic mind remains materialistic after death. Often it denies that it is dead, and considers its psychic or its spiritual body to be a physical body, so that it is still alive on earth. Even when it realizes it has passed through death, it may still deny there is a God and refuse to listen to any who could teach it. Thus it will remain in hell. Nevertheless, the number of good materialists is far smaller than most people would suppose. Even on earth many a man who outwardly poses as a materialist in his heart of hearts really believes and comes to our realm. Further, after death such a man usually remains for a considerable time in his psychic body, and the conditions of life on that plane, that is the astral, soon convinces most men of some at least of the most elementary spiritual truths. While on the subject of the psychic body, let me draw your attention to the fact that you have misunderstood the seventh plane in my chart. You have understood it as the earth on which you are now living. Gone west, it is really the earth plane, and can be separated broadly into the division of the incarnate and of the discarnate spirits. The former are of course yourselves, the latter the earthbound, and also a crowd of other organisms, such as elementals, empty psychic bodies, and so forth. The dead man first passes through this stage, and only when he has dropped his psychic body can his spiritual body enter the sixth plane, even hell. I was but a brief space in it, and must have dropped my psychic body almost before I realized I had one. I believe it took place as soon as the bedroom gave way to this beautiful scenery. The officer, however, spent a long time in the psychic body, and has a very clear recollection of dropping it. I hope I have now made plain the relation between faith and conduct. Now go to sleep, And, standing in front of me, J.W., he made a number of passes, and I sank into oblivion.